I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Representative Kevin Yoder has a lot of people trying to get his job. At least six want a chance to take him on in November's general election. But first, one of them has to secure the Democratic nomination. Earlier this month, we met two of those candidates. Today, we meet two more. Sharice Davids worked in the White House during the Obama-Trump transition, and Jay Seide is a business owner who challenged Yoder in 2016. After that, is your regular 9-to-5 wearing you down? The Smart Money experts are here with financial advice you should consider before making a big career change. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Six candidates are vying for the right to take on incumbent Congressman Kevin Yoder in the November election. You'll meet two of them today. Sharice Davids and Jay Seide are here in the studio to talk about why each of them should be the Democratic nominee this fall. Jay Seide was the Democratic nominee back in 2016 and is a market analyst. Jay, welcome back. Nice to have you.
Thanks you for having me, Steve.
Sharice Davids is a lawyer and political newcomer. Nice to have you too, Sharice. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Sharice, why do you want to be a member of Congress? What's all this about?
I think part of what we're seeing right now, not just here in the 3rd District, although we're seeing a lot of it with six people vying to be the Democratic nominee, but across the country, I think what we're seeing is a lot of people who have both the skills and qualifications to be members of Congress and are frankly dissatisfied with the inaction of the people that we've elected. And then also, personally, I just want to see a decision-making body that's more representative and reflective of what our country looks like, what this district looks like, not just in terms of demographics, but also in terms of experience, lived experience. And I think we're lacking that in Congress right now.
Jay Seide, why do you want to be a member of Congress?
I'm running because I think I can make a difference. You know, when I ran in 2016, I got exposed to the underbelly of congressional politics. And the problem we have is it takes a lot of time and energy to run and win. And what happens is the people that do win go to Washington with the first priority is keeping that job. They're wanting a political career. They're usually younger and look at this as a stepping stone for a big career in politics. And they're susceptible to being corrupted by money and power. Myself, you know, I'm 61 years old. I was a corporate VP for over 20 years. I've had a long 40-year professional life. I'm at the stage of my career. If I win and go to Washington, I won't be afraid to take political risk. I'll go there to do what's right for the constituents. If it costs me my career, I'm more than happy to do it. And I think that's what's wrong with Washington.
So one term for you would be okay, you're saying?
Well, I'd like to stay there as long as possible. But if I have to sacrifice what's good for the district to win a second term, I'll fight for the district before I do that.
Sharice, what do you bring to the table? What skills do you bring to Washington that voters should be aware of here?
I'd say the biggest differentiator in terms of my skills and qualifications are my federal policy experience. I have spent time implementing federal policy.
You were a White House fellow under President Obama, right?
Mm-hmm. And then in terms of creating policy and being at the table at the highest levels of our federal government, while I was a White House fellow, I had the opportunity to help participate in the creation of federal policy. So I have experience on both sides of the coin, both creating and implementing with the community development work that I was doing for a little while. And I heavily involved in USDA programs and other workforce programs, those kinds of things, to see where that disconnect exists between people who have to implement policy and the people who are creating it.
Jay, how about you? What do you bring?
When I was in my professional life, I was a commodity trader. And you talk about a very intense competitive environment. And that's the same thing you are when you're a congressman. You're fighting for the competitiveness and the efficiency of government. And so when I started with the company, I was a trainee. Within 5 years, I was a VP because I'm very effective at finding solutions that are efficient and fair. And I'm willing to go to Washington and do what it takes to make sure the right people are in the right position to make this country what it should be.
Jay Seide, let me come to you with this next question here. What has Congressman Yoder done that he's made the two of you give up sizable chunks of your lives, as you were just pointing out, to run for this office?
Exactly what I talked about in my intro. When I was asked to run in 2016 by the party, I said, well, let me look at Kevin Yoder and just see how bad he is. And I looked at what he's been doing since he's been in office. In fact, Kevin Yoder was raised a Democrat his whole life. He went to KU, was president of Young Democrats at KU, went to law school, was president of Young Law Students of KU, came out of law school, went to work for Dennis Moore as a staffer.
Then you think you'd like him.
Well, I'm just saying what he's done, he's become a professional politician. He's there for the career. He wants to go there and get reelected and make friends in Washington so he can move up the food chain. The people, what the people need in the district comes way down the priority list because he's worried about keeping his job. And when I saw that, I go, I want somebody to go to Washington that's actually there for the right reasons.
But he's been elected four times, so that would begin to suggest that people seem to like what he's done so far.
I disagree. If you talk to most of the people out there, they don't like Kevin Yoder. But he's good at getting reelected because he's good at raising money. He's good at making the right friends in powerful places. And, you know, I don't care who you are or where you are. I looked at the congressional races over the last 30 years. If you're a first-time candidate trying to beat an incumbent, you have a 97% chance of losing. So Kevin's first run in 2010 was against another first-time candidate, Stephanie Moore.
Right.
And he managed to eke out a win there. But ever since then, it's been Kevin against a first-time congressional Democrat, and you just can't win. You have to run twice to beat an incumbent.
Charisse, what's your thinking here about what Kevin Yoder has done in Congress that has made you want to run this race?
Well, I'll take it. So I'll give a threefold answer to that,
okay.
Three-part answer. So first, I think who you represent is indicated by who you take money from. So taking a lot of money from the gun lobby, taking a lot of money from payday lenders, that to me says these are the groups that you represent, not the 3rd District. So that's one piece of it. The second piece is, frankly, the voting record. You know, I think that voting to get rid of the ACA without a replacement, an appropriate replacement, you know, the tax bill that I think, you know, in the short term, some people might see benefits. But if we look long term and what Kansas has already gone through, I think what we can take from that is we've learned the lessons of cutting taxes for very, very wealthy people. So that's a second piece is the voting record. And then the third piece is, I would say, a little more overarching, which is I think we see right now a lot of politicians who don't say what they mean and do what they say. So telling us that you're moderate and then voting otherwise is not okay. Also, not standing up and saying this, it does not align with American values. These actions of this current administration do not align with what I think of as American values. That says a lot. And I think if you want to be a decision maker, that's one thing. But if you want to be a leader, then your role is to stand up and fight against oppressive policies and make it known that the people in your district do not agree with oppressive policies or things that are dehumanizing.
Charisse Davids and Jay Sidey, two candidates for the Democratic nomination for the 3rd District of Kansas, are my guests here. Jay Sidey, what kind of job has President Trump done so far in your estimation?
Well, I think he's probably the worst president in my lifetime, if not the worst president ever.
How do you really feel, Jay?
I was afraid of him in 2016 when I was running. And I was Kevin Yoder was the first congressionally elected official to endorse him. And I was using that as a weapon to attack Kevin. And a lot of people were a little bit concerned about that, you know, people on my staff, because they didn't know how Kansas people felt about Trump. And, you know, because of his reality show celebrity, he's been able to get away with a lot of things a normal politician is not going to be able to get away with.
Right.
And in fact, even Mueller is having a hard time getting a lot of traction against him.
The federal prosecutor is looking into his Russian ties and everything else. Yeah.
And I think Congress is the fail-safe to protect us from somebody like Trump. And that's why I want to get there, because I'm afraid for my children. I've got kids that go to elementary school here and middle school here, and I'm worried about their future, and I'm worried about their kids' future. So I want to step in and do something where I can go to Congress and actually protect us from Trump's, crazy policies that do nothing to help this country.
Charisse Davids, how do you feel about President Trump?
I think what we need in a president is someone who is thoughtful, qualified, and recognizes the, I think there's a lot of talk about we're a country of laws. And, what I saw during, I was there over the transition from the Obama administration to this current administration. And I honestly, it's funny because I always tell people I didn't necessarily have an appreciation for bureaucracy until I saw that when you have an executive that is willing to not follow process, not follow procedure, bureaucracy and our federal civil servants are the only thing that keep this country on track sometimes. And that's what we saw was career federal civil service folks who are standing up and saying, this does not follow the letter of the law.
Yeah.
I'm not going to do that because you're not following the letter of the law. We need a president who's going to follow the letter of the law. And will also, in instances where the law has not caught up to where we are as a country, be willing to make progress in those areas. And this president doesn't do that. And I don't, I'm waiting for the day that we have a president that does.
Let's turn to some issues that are on the table here. Immigration emerging once again as a major issue in this campaign cycle, with President Trump facing criticism for his administration's policy of separating migrant families apprehended at the border. The administration is saying that it's taken nearly 2,000 children away from their parents in a six-week period ending last month as part of this new zero-tolerance policy. Charisse, what do you make of it?
It's funny, I was just talking about us being a country of laws. So I think that there are two pieces to this. One is the moral implications. Who are we as a country, and what kind of country do we want to be? And then there's our adherence to the laws of the land. And, I've spent time looking up what treaties are we a part of? Because if you look in the Constitution, it says that the Constitution and treaties are the supreme law of the land. And the United States has entered into numerous treaties related to human rights. And right now, what I'm seeing are what I believe are human rights violations, separating people when they are coming particularly to seek asylum, but separating people, separating families violates basic human rights. And I'm not okay with that. And I think that the conversation should be rooted in both, if we're going to have an attorney general that is supposed to be upholding the laws of the land, talking about the Bible, that certainly speaks to our morality. And then we also need to be talking about the treaties that we're a part of. And the attorney general should definitely be well-versed on which treaties we've signed on to. And that have been ratified.
Jay Sadi, what do you think of this policy of the Trump administration?
It's horrific. It's embarrassing. It's a stain on the American history. And the attorney general is the problem. He's the one that's okayed what they're doing. And then Trump's trying to blame it on the Democrats.
Right.
And then Yoder is trying to wishy-washy around with statements that claim that what they're doing is legal. It's the same problem. There's so much information out there that people are overwhelmed trying to figure out who's telling the truth. And that's where, looking at third-party resources like you guys that can kind of differentiate fact from fiction. And that's what this country needs. They need a news source that they can trust that's going to give them the facts, not some spin that's paid for by corporate America.
Is Donald Trump telling the truth in this situation, Jay?
No, he is not.
Yeah. Charisse, any question in your mind?
No. And then particularly since you all did that story, fact-checking Kevin Yoder's statements recently, I think that was those are exactly the kinds of things that we need, fact-checking and folks willing to say that's not the truth.
Mm-hmm. Again, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're visiting this morning with two candidates running for the Democratic nomination in Kansas's 3rd District that covers Wyandotte and Johnson County. Sharice Davids, Jay Seide are here in the studio with me. What about the soaring cost of a college education? That's a big concern for a lot of parents, Sharice, that you would be representing in Washington. What can you do about it as a member of Congress? What would you do?
So I'm going to add to that. It's a big concern of parents, but it's also a big concern of folks who are coming out of college right now, who are looking to go into college, people who have graduated from college in the last, 10 years. I have myself student loan debt that I'm still paying off. And I think that this is, it should not be that your first consideration when you're trying to figure out what you're going to do with your life once you've finished college is, how do I pay off these student loans? I think there are a number of things that we should be doing to help incentivize folks to go to college if that's what they want to do, and also incentivizing folks to go to trade schools. And, you know, I went from Johnson County Community College to Cornell for law school. And, you know, when I think about that journey and how many opportunities going to community college gave me, I want to make sure that we have those opportunities for others and far into the future. And I think that right now what we're seeing is a step away from that. And it's very, very concerning. I think that we need to make sure that folks who have student loans maintain federal protections when they want to refinance to get a lower interest rate. Yeah. When, you know, when people are struggling, when people go into, we need to make sure to protect the ability for people who decide they want to go into public service to have their loan repayment plan maintained and continued, and not arbitrarily decided that it's going to be discontinued, and, you know, removing like silly restrictions that make it so if you miss some reporting deadline, automatically the 5 years that you've spent.
So how would you approach the issue? How would you cut costs? How would you help kids? What's the answer?
Well, so I think there are a couple of things. One is that the addressing student loan, actually addressing the student loan programs, the federal student loan programs. And then also
to do what? Lower the interest rates or what are you talking about?
Well, both lower interest rates and also enable people to refinance. There are a lot of people who have high interest rates on their student loans. Also, I think there's another piece, which is increasing Pell Grants, access to Pell Grants, you know, because my experience has been that people who are able to access Pell Grants are exactly the people who need who end up getting a lot of student loans. Yeah. And so I think that we need to make sure that we have policies like that in place.
Jay Seide, what would you do about the soaring cost of college educations in this country?
I think since I graduated from college, it's gone up like 4,000%. It's just amazing what's happened. The first step is to renew the Higher Education Act that expires in the next year. And basically what's going on is corporate America is trying to dumb it down because, like every other problem we have, it's usually the U.S. citizens that are fighting the multinational corporations that are trying to profit off this industry, the banking lobby. You know, they're trying to profit off all these student loans. And as a country, we need to realize that our people are our most valuable resource, and you need to invest in them. When I was in corporate America, I was a very liberal guy in a sea of conservatism. And when I got there, unions were being busted, and the management had a relatively dim look on their employees. And I came in there, young guy from Minnesota, pretty liberal, and I said, you need to look at your employees like they're an asset that you need to optimize because the performance is going to go up. They're going to be happier. Mm-hmm. Everything's going to work better. If you look at your employees like a liability that you try to get as much out of as possible with the least amount of cost, you're going to end up with a subpar performance.
So more money for Pell Grants would be something you'd favor
as
well?
Yes, I think you have to go farther than that. Mm-hmm. I think you have to look at, if we don't invest in our students, in our people, so they can come out of college without a sea of debt around their neck, our country's going to lose steam compared to the rest of the world.
What about a different topic here, recreational use of marijuana? Would you legalize it or not, Jay?
I think it has less harm than a lot of other things that are legal. And I definitely think we should legalize the medical use of it for people that would benefit from it.
How about recreational use?
Recreational use, I think I could go either way on it. I don't personally use it. I don't have a lot of friends that personally use it. Do I think we should spend a lot of resources policing it? No, I think we could spend those resources helping people that maybe use too much of any substance, whether it's alcohol or whatever. Instead of trying to police the supply, let's try and fix the cause, why the people are overusing things like that.
How about legalizing marijuana, Charisse Davids?
Well, so one, I would definitely want to remove it as a Schedule I drug, which is fully in the purview of the federal government to do that. I do think that this is an interesting federalism question. You know, should the federal government be telling states whether they should legalize or not legalize? And as a person sitting here who's running for Congress and not the Kansas State House, I would say that certainly it needs to be removed as a Schedule I drug, and that I don't think that the federal government should be prosecuting marijuana-related crimes, especially in states that have legalized it. And then I think an important part of the conversation needs to be around the criminal justice aspect of this, which is that, you know, there are so many people who are in federal and state prisons that have nonviolent drug offense, marijuana-related drug offenses that, you know, when we take this drug off the Schedule I, then we definitely need to be reevaluating how many people and releasing people who have been convicted of things that now people are making billions of dollars off of.
Let's turn to another topic that's on the minds of so many folks, particularly in our area, given the recent events in town here the last few days, guns and the ongoing concern over school shootings across the country. Do you favor an assault weapons ban, Charisse, and should teachers and schools be armed in, you know, this attempt to ward off school shooters?
The idea that we would arm teachers is so ridiculous. You know, we need to be paying teachers, not talking about putting guns in their hands in the classroom. You know, I'm definitely in favor. So that's it on that one. Full stop.
Assault weapons.
And then when I look at gun safety, I think of it, and I'm trying to advocate for us to take a holistic approach to it. It's a public health issue, and there are what I consider to be three aspects, which is the metrics we need to study the problem, the people who are getting their hand, who can get access to firearms. And there's a whole slew of things in there. And then the third piece is the hardware, which you're talking about now. And I definitely think that what we need to do is, one, for sure, ban bump stocks. They were clearly designed to get around our ban on fully automatic weapons. Mm-hmm. And then when you get into the assault rifle conversation, I think we need to make sure that what we do is figure out how to properly define what is an assault rifle, because otherwise we're going to run into the same issue we're running into with bump stocks. And so I think, you know, the conversation should be as holistic as possible. Otherwise, we're putting Band-Aids on a problem that is really a public health issue.
Jay Seide.
Yes, definitely should ban assault weapons in the general public. A compromise might be that they could have assault-style, military-style weapons on military bases that are controlled by the military, and maybe a citizen could come there for training and actually fire something on the military base, but not take those kind of weapons off the base. Mm-hmm. As far as teachers having guns, like Sheree said, that's ridiculous. You just saw what happened in Wyandotte County with two sheriffs. They're well-trained police officers with guns, and they still were unable to control gun violence. The problem with gun violence in America, because our society is not that much different than the rest of the world, why do we have so much more gun violence? Because we have too many guns. There's guns everywhere, and the first solution is to get rid of some of those guns. And the first solution that shouldn't affect anybody's constitutional rights is a buyback.
Yeah. Charisse, I just wanted to catch a couple of things before we leave here. One of them, you'd be the first female Native American member of Congress and the first openly gay member of the Kansas delegation. How big a deal is that in your view? How important should how should voters weigh that?
Well, I think voters should weigh my policy experience and, you know, the time I've my professional qualifications in terms of how they want to vote for me as related to the or vis-a-vis the other candidates. But in terms of our societal progression, what does leadership in our country look like? I certainly think it's very important that we have not just here in the 3rd District, but across the country, we have a lot of people who are going to who will make history no matter what happens in this election cycle. I think that when people think about who do we want to be as a country, do we want to have a leadership that is representative and reflective of who we are and what our experiences are? I think that is something that is very important. And it might not be the reason that people vote for me, because they should vote for me because I'm the most qualified candidate. But I do think that when we think broadly, long term, who do we want to be as a country? What direction are we moving? My campaign and campaigns similar to mine across the country are ones that just are a demonstration of where we're going.
We're going to leave our conversation there. I want to thank Jay Seide, a Democratic nominee in 2016 in the 3rd District, a market analyst, for coming in today. Charisse Davids, a lawyer and a political newcomer, also running in the 3rd District. Thank you both very much.
Thank you, Steve.
The primary is, what, August 7th?
August 7th.
It's coming up pretty fast, right?
Be sure and vote.
Here it comes. Okay.
Be sure and vote for Charisse Davids.
Time for a break. When we come back, we're going to switch topics and talk about the whole idea of switching jobs and things to think about if you qualify in that area. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Last week, Ken Selzer told us why he thinks his experience as state insurance commissioner makes him the best choice for Kansas governor this fall. You can hear that and the rest of my conversations with the gubernatorial candidates. Just go to kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, Dr. Cynthia Lane joins us. She's headed up the Kansas City, Kansas public schools for the last 8 years, but is retiring at the end of the month. We'll discuss her career and find out where she'd like to see the district go after her departure. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. So you're thinking about switching jobs. You aren't the only one. The job market is as hot as the shingles on your roof these days as the U.S. Jobless rate continues to drop. But switching jobs is about a lot more than just the salary. Now a conversation about just what else you should consider as you think about changing companies. Our smart money experts are with us once again, and they are Lucas Butchel is a principal with KHC Wealth Management. Lucas, always good to have you.
Absolutely. Thank you.
David Jackson is a certified financial planner, practitioner, and financial advisor with Waddell and Reed Financial Advisors. David, welcome back.
Hey, good morning, Steve.
Barbara McMahon is president of Innovest Financial Partners in Brookside. Barbara, good morning.
Hi.
Well, let's start with some current events, things in the news right now. Lucas, the U.S. unemployment rate has dropped to 3.8%. That's the lowest since April of 2000, and kind of remarkable.
Yeah, the labor market has finally kind of gotten to a recovery point, and it's nice to see some of these really strong readings and numbers. The other thing I think is probably just as important is wage growth is starting to kindle again, and up over 2% now, which, again, people are earning more money as the economy's gotten better and the employment market has gotten better.
Well, here's your 10-point bonus question today, Barbara. The unemployment rate right now is 3.8%. What's the record low? Any idea?
The record low? Well, let me take you back.
I looked it up last night.
Oh, you did? All right. Well, I'm going to go back to 1969. Mm. But interestingly, the population was a lot smaller then. Mm-hmm. So we've duplicated the 69 number, but I don't know, it'd be interesting to do an inflation factor on that, wouldn't it?
You go back to 1953, the record low was 2.5%.
Wow.
According to my expert analysis, David
okay.
Jackson.
Yeah.
Wow.
So we have a little ways to go to get to that.
Yes,
but
we do.
3.8 is not too bad, is it?
Well, it's kind of interesting because you have a lot of people that are getting jobs, but then you have the baby boom generation that is leaving the workforce as well. So there's some people that are thinking the 3.8 may be closer to a 5. You know, the Fed used to say 4% unemployment. It's basically zero
full employment.
Yeah, full employment. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's not anymore because you do have so many people leaving the workforce. And so Lucas alluded to the fact that wages are finally starting to grow. but they're really not growing fast enough. Their wages are growing at about 2.6%. But if inflation is growing at 2%, and then you factor in the fact that people are always having to pay a little bit more for their health insurance, they're not really seeing any real wage growth. So that wage number needs to be somewhere closer to 3.5% to 4%.
Help me understand this. If unemployment rate is so low, why isn't the personal income rate
that is the question.
Increasing more
that
rapidly?
That is the big question.
Senator Roy Blunt was just in Missouri the other day talking about we can't find enough people to fill jobs.
Right.
You're hearing politicians talk about this issue in a way we haven't heard them talk about it in decades.
Right, yeah. And it is a real mystery that we're not getting wage growth commensurate with this low unemployment rate. And I don't know.
Lucas?
Yeah, so one of the things that people are maybe surmising is that with the baby boomers now retiring, those tend to be folks that are, at their highest earning level, and they're being replaced with much younger workers generally. And so what you're seeing is potentially the wage numbers being kind of kept down a little bit, the wage growth numbers, by the fact that you're replacing high earning jobs with or high earning people with lower earning people because they have less experience and they're younger.
Yeah.
And something else I think you're seeing is companies have a lot of cash, so they could theoretically raise wages if they cared to. But what we're seeing in the market instead is a lot of mergers and acquisitions. That's how companies are choosing to grow. They're buying another company, incorporating it, and that's how they're using their cash instead of actually raising the wages.
So would you expect personal income rates to rise as this year continues? Would that be a reasonable expectation?
I think it would. Fast enough to keep pace with inflation? I hope so. It's going to be a very interesting year because I think the economy is kind of in a state of flux right now. We're still seeing the effects of the new tax cut, which put more money in people's pockets. And eventually that's going to phase out. And I think we're going to get kind of the reality check at that point to see, are companies wealthy enough to pay these kind of wages and will they choose to?
Yeah. Okay, let's turn to our main topic this morning, and that's making a job change and what you should consider if you're going down that road. There are lots of factors here, and salary isn't the only thing, although it's a big thing. Lucas, start us off by talking about salaries and bonuses and all that good stuff.
Yeah, so obviously salary is the headliner, right, that everybody kind of looks to. And if someone's wise, they'll kind of continue to look at all the other items. But when you're looking at salary, obviously comparing it to where you're at, the bonus potential, I think, is one that people sometimes look at and kind of see it from their current view. So how you get paid bonuses today at your company, it may be different, and the metrics may be different, and the ability to hit that target may be different at the company you're going to. So really understanding the culture about how variable comp gets paid, whether it's bonus or some other sort, so you're kind of comparing apples to apples with what you have today.
Are you okay with asking those questions? I mean, how detailed can you get in a job interview without coming off as being someone who's going to be on the difficult side, Barbara?
Well, there are resources, and one of them is a website called Glassdoor.com, where before you walk in, you can get some idea of what people in a comparable position might be paid, and that can be very useful. At this point, you have to have the conversation, and I think it's become less difficult because some of the hiring managers that I've been talking to are offering jobs and then getting turned down because that person, the candidate, has already taken a job elsewhere. Mm-hmm. So I think it moves this, what used to be an uncomfortable topic, up pretty high, and it makes it an easier discussion to have.
Okay, let's go to some calls here. Spencer from Kansas City, Missouri. Spencer, you're on Up to Date. We're talking with our smart money experts about job changes. Good morning.
Good morning. Wonderful panel. I have a question. From an employer standpoint and an employee standpoint, during the recession, a lot of people left the job market. Labor force participation rate declined significantly. How should employers and how should individuals that maybe want to get back into the labor force really manage to leverage and plan for that group of people who are talented but otherwise on disability or sheltering in academia?
Hmm. David, do you want to take a run at that?
It's a tricky question. A lot of people got out of the labor force and started taking what were we calling them. Well, self-employment type of job.
Freelancers.
Yeah, freelancers. There's another word we've been using.
The gig economy.
Yeah, the gig economy. That are coming back into the labor force now because jobs have opened up. I'd like to back up on for a second. One of the things, employers are not paying more commensurate with the unemployment rate. But when you go to change jobs because you're in a competitive situation, that's where the opportunity lies. And you can bargain for or negotiate for a higher rate, wage than maybe you could just going with your current employer. So I think there are opportunities out there. And I think if we look back over the last 20 years, employers are not showing the loyalty that they used to. So employees should take the same attitude. And it's like, what's best for me?
Hmm. And Spencer, I think another way to approach it is when you approach the job, don't say, I have this experience, I'm the perfect fit. Stress your skills and how those skills fit the job that you are applying for. Because with more jobs available than people, they're going to be looking for, or I would think a bright employer would be looking for a skill set, not somebody that they can train in the way that the company works. And so that's how the resume, I believe, and I'm not a job counselor.
But are you recommending that people then, to go on Spencer's point, do you dip into savings for additional education and skills? Is this a, you know, or is this job market so hungry that maybe you can forego some of that, you know?
I think the dynamics are changing and that those folks have a lot more opportunity now. They probably wouldn't have been the top candidate, right, if there's lots of different people applying for the same job because they don't have that experience, recent experience. I think that game has changed now. And so I think, to Barbara's point, highlighting your skills, I think the other thing that employers look for is – what have you done during this layoff to maintain your ability to be a good employee? So have you gotten continue to take education or keep your certifications up if that's applicable? And have you volunteered or been active some other way to remain sharp? I think highlighting that would be a critical element.
How about career potential, your ability to advance in your career and earn more as being a valuable asset, Barbara, that you can actually offer an employer as you're seeking a job there?
You know, you remember the old interview question, where do you see yourself in 5 years? I always hated that one.
Because no one really knows.
Who knows? You know, but I think what people are looking for, the hiring managers that I'm talking to, they want somebody who's a good fit. I mean, you know, the right people on the bus has become kind of a slang term for that. And you want to make sure that your interests are aligned with the company's interest. And so I don't think there's anything wrong in saying I'd really like to be in a management position 3 years from now. I would appreciate any training you can give me to help me do that. One of the things I think you might also inquire about during the interview process is if there's a possibility of an equity position, especially at a small firm, because we've alluded to the baby boomers moving out. Is it possible that you have the drive and the skill set and would like to own part of that company and be part of the management team? And I think at a job interview, that would be a good thing to bring up, is I really see myself with a future in your company, and here is why.
Yeah. David, makes sense?
It absolutely does. And the millennial generation takes a different attitude about working than the baby boomers, because the baby boomers were like all about, let me get this money. The millennials are all about job satisfaction, flexibility on the job. You know, can I get the time off that I need? Can I pursue my other interests besides my job? So when you go into an employer, you know, you want to find out what is their culture and are they going to, is it going to fit your personality and what's really important to
you? How do you find that out? Culture.
It is okay to ask those kind of questions. You know, I have a 30-year-old son, and he was just telling me over the weekend that he's got a job opportunity that fits him perfect. They don't require him to dress up every day, that they are very casual, and his mindset is, oh, this is a perfect fit for me. You know, he's a millennial. He's thinking that way.
Yeah. You know, Lucas, one of the other wild card factors anytime you switch jobs is health insurance, and trying to wrap your arms around that octopus can be really challenging. What do you advise on that front?
Yeah, this is an area that you really have to do your homework on and get the details now more than ever, just as costs have been pushed more and more down to the individual and the family.
Yeah.
So understanding
about it.
What the premium costs are going to be for you out of pocket, and also for family members if you're adding dependents, because that can be eye-opening if you're moving from an employer that used to pay most or all of the health care costs for you and your family. There are a lot less companies that are willing to do that now. The other thing is deductibles. A lot of people stop there, though, is premium and deductible. Other really critical items are network coverage. So can I continue to go to the doctors and hospitals that I want? That's an area that's changed dramatically in the last 3 years. drug coverage. A lot of times the drug coverage has changed. And then some tax advantages with health savings accounts is one that is important to understand.
Yeah. Another one that's on anybody's list should be vacation time, sick leave, flexible hours, that kind of thing. I'm always kind of amazed, Barbara, when you talk to like friends who have switched a job and you'll ask them, well, how much vacation time you're going to get. These are folks who are a little bit older. They'll just say, well, you know, I'm the typical 3 weeks or whatever, 2 weeks. And you're like, man, at this point in your career, you should have did you negotiate that? No, I didn't really bring it up. This is a good one to bring up, right?
Well, it is a good one to bring up. But I want to get back to David's point about millennials and how they're replacing the baby boomers. Sometimes what is more important than a vacation is flexibility.
Right.
And I know in my office...
Flexibility meaning?
Meaning you can work the hours that you need to get the job done.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll use my own office as an example. We have younger employees who need more flexible hours than perhaps the older because they have young families. And so we have structured work hours around that. So everybody, I hope, feels that it is fair, but the job is getting done.
Mm.
Have the time. So my experience is the flexibility probably is more important than the vacation time.
That's interesting.
Yeah, but for the millennials, I'd agree. I mean, they want that flexibility, especially young families. You know, that's so important for them to be able to take off when they need to for the kids.
For a baseball game, for a doctor's appointment.
But nonetheless, you can negotiate when it comes to vacation time.
Oh, absolutely. And you should. You know, once you're getting pretty close where you know you're getting the job. I have a friend who recently changed jobs and they offered him the 3 weeks and he negotiated and got the 5 weeks. So it's good to bring that up, especially later on in the process when you're getting pretty close to them offering you the position.
I would throw into this discussion too the ability to work at home. That is really important to a lot of people. Again, going back to my office, everybody has a laptop. On the days when schools are shut down and ICE is covering the city, it is understood that everybody has their laptop and we have systems set up where we can all reach each other and function normally.
Okay. How about retirement plan options, Lucas, and employer match, those kinds of things? Again, may not seem like a big deal at the time, but it will be a big deal at some point down the road.
Absolutely. So really understanding what the employer contribution is going to be, how they're going to participate. Most employers do that at some level. So understanding it. And then number two, taking advantage of it. I can't tell you how many times I hear stories about people that have a company match or contributions that are available to them, and all they have to do is contribute 4% of their salary to save, and they don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
That's free money you're leaving on the table. It's a no-brainer. And the truth is, you know, you really should be doing a minimum of 10% of your compensation to savings and retirement anyway. And so, you know, just kind of assuming you're going to start there, it will keep you on track, but also make sure you're taking advantage of the stuff that the employer is doing for you.
There's also other categories here, Barbara: disability insurance, life insurance, educational assistance, student debt assistance, community involvement. Which of these things would you highlight as being things worth talking about?
All of the above, I think.
All of the above,
But let's start with insurance, because I think insurance is at the core of what people need to do. They need disability, although many would be reluctant to admit that. They need life insurance. It's a good way to supplement a private policy. And I would add long-term care insurance. For people getting into their 50s that believe they're going to retire from a company, long-term care insurance, which we used to call nursing home insurance, just so I'm clear, can often be purchased much less costly for much less within the company than on an outside policy.
If they offer it.
If they offer it, yeah. And I'd like to see more demand for that to be offered. So I would say for that list, for the people I'm working with who are mainly boomers, it would be the insurance. It really would be the insurance.
It's interesting that student debt assistance, David Jackson, has become sort of a bigger issue, and young people saying, I want help with that. Can your company help? And some companies are.
Yeah, I haven't heard about a lot of them. I've been hearing a little bit about it, but I haven't heard specific companies that are offering. And I hope it becomes a huge trend, because you take the average graduate comes out with $30,000 worth of student loan debt. They're paying $300 or $400 a month to service that debt. So It really does saddle them with a burden. And if more companies would step up and give them some assistance, it could make a huge difference, not only for them, but for the overall economy.
Okay. Let's turn to just a final topic here today, this notion that it's a hot time of year, literally, but also for selling homes out there. and what you should know if you're buying or selling a home this summer. Lucas, let's talk about it from the standpoint of the sellers. What should those folks be thinking about?
The first thing is expect your house to move fast, assuming you've got it priced reasonably. I mean, there's story after story of people selling their homes in 1 or 2 days. And if you haven't prepared for that, if you think, I'm gonna be able to work through this transition over the course of a couple months, you're going to be surprised.
Mm-hmm.
And so having a plan to move out quickly, temporary housing is a really important thing now. So being ready for that house to sell quickly.
It's amazing to me how hot the market is for home sellers, and the notion that the supply of homes in the Kansas City area isn't all that great, and they're being snapped up. And I live in Northeast Johnson County, and holy smokes, people are all those things you hear. People are going for higher than the asking price, and bidding wars, and all that stuff is happening, at least in my neck of the woods right now.
Well, and I'm on the Missouri side in the Brookside neighborhood, and it's the same sort of thing. I heard recently that there's something like a 3-day inventory on the market, which is nothing. I know one of my clients got multiple, like more than 10 offers the day it was listed.
10 offers.
More than. Mm-hmm. It's astonishing.
Which makes me think that the initial asking price, maybe they lowballed it. They should have gone a little higher.
I don't think so. Right now, houses are running, the appreciation is about 7%, and that's nationwide. I think Kansas City actually is much higher. Now, the expectation is that's going to cool off. Probably sometime next year, and just kind of slowly ratchet down.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to sell, I guess the advice is probably do it now.
Yeah. There's also this question of how much money should you spend to improve the home to get it ready to sell, David. I mean, where do you come down on that question? What should you do as a seller?
Well, you should have that conversation with your realtor, but be careful because, you know, a lot of realtors will say, okay, change the countertops, change the flooring. And you may change the countertops, and the person who buys the house says, you know, that's the exact opposite color that I would have went with. I'm going to replace these. So, yeah, you don't want to put too much money into a house to make it, you know, sell ready if you're not going to get your money out of it. Mm-hmm. So you have to be careful with that.
That's interesting.
Especially in a hot market like this, because somebody just bought a house across the street from me, and they went in the house and they said, yeah, it needed a lot of remodeling, but this is the perfect neighborhood we wanted to be in. So we'll remodel it ourselves.
But there's also this thinking out there that, you know, the sellers these days want homes they want them staged to look like hotel rooms almost. The notion that the better shape your home is, the better off you're going to be selling the darn thing.
Well, I think that's also true. You want it to look really good. You want it to show well. But just to have it show well is different than, you know, I have to completely remodel my kitchen and bathroom. And so, you know, being wise about, you know, not going and sinking $5,000 or $10,000 in and expecting you're going to get that back, especially in a market where you're probably going to be able to sell it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be that it had to show well and have those updates for it to be able to sell at all or very quickly. Now that game has kind of changed and the sellers are in a much better position.
How about buyers, Barbara, just in the 30 seconds we have left here, what should they be thinking about?
Well, they should get pre-approved for a mortgage before they ever start. And if they don't think they will be pre-approved, or if they talk to the banker and find it's kind of iffy, clean up the credit quickly, mm-hmm. pay off credit cards and things like that. Now, interest rates are still low, but they are rising. And in the Kansas City area right now, good average on 30 years, about 4.7%, of 15 years running about 3.9%. So again, you probably want to move quickly because those interest rates will start to inch up over the course of the year, I think.
Some good advice from our smart money experts. And today, once again, they were Barbara McMahon, president of Innovest Financial Partners in Brookside, Lucas Butchell, principal with KHC Wealth Management, David Jackson's with Waddell and Reed Financial Advisors. Thank you all very much. Appreciate
great being with
it.
You.
Thank
yeah.
you.
You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Follow me at Steve Kraske. And don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. Tomorrow, Kansas City, Kansas Public School District Superintendent Cynthia Lane reflects on her 3 decades of work for the district. She's set to retire at month's end. The show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, Dallas Johnson, and Emily Park. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date. Thank you.